Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. You may retreat to a cabin, a shack, a cottage any time of year, but summer pulls the heart to the getaway, and it hardly matters how humble it may be. In 1788, Thomas Jefferson wrote, "I'd rather be shut up in a very modest cottage than to occupy the most splendid post which any human power can give." The humble cabin, cottage, may be the best. This hour on Point, we'll take a look at the endless appeal of the humble summer cottage with a hardy soul who restored a tiny one and an architect who's looked deeply at what gives simple getaways their magic. You can join the conversation. Do you have a cabin, a shack, a cottage that calls to you? What does it do for you, to you? What makes it magic? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Chicago is Teresa Surratt, author of A Very Modest Cottage, the story of her personal quest to salvage a 12-by-12 childhood dream. Teresa, it's great to have you with us. Thanks for joining.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And with me in the studio is Duo Dickinson, architect, co-founder of the Congress of Residential Architecture, a kind of philosopher of home design and modest home design. He's author of House on a Budget and Small Houses for the Next Century. Duo Dickinson, it's great to have you here as well.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
All right, Teresa, to your little tiny cabin. This was on your grandma's property in Western Beardstown, Illinois. Out there on the Illinois River, out toward the Mississippi. Describe this little, I must say from the photos in your book, when you were first poking around at it, very dilapidated cabin. What was it?
Oh my gosh. It was a shell, essentially. It was a shell of its former self. And I remember the first time seeing it, I was 4 or 5 years old. And it was so sad. Even at that age, I remember looking at it and saying, where's the people that live in there? Because as a little kid, you're looking at this small little house, and of course you want to move in and fix it up.
As a kid, absolutely.
And that's what we wanted to do, and it sat next to my grandmother's house, and it sat there for 30 years almost. And so, of course, I always dreamed and talked to my dad about someday I'm going to move into that house. And like you said, it was almost essentially 12 by 12 was the exterior dimension.
Right,
the inside
right.
was like 11 by 11.
Right.
So it was full of just of tomato cages and junk. It really wasn't safe for a kid, but
right.
I made up my mind, even at that age, I was going to move in.
A little storage shed. I think people can easily visualize it, and there are photos at the website, onpointradio.org, but they can easily visualize it if they think back to what it began its life as, which was one of those tiny, tiny tourist cabins that you'd see in clusters of 4, 5, or 6 along the highways of America in the 1920s, basically just big enough for, a couple of cots and room to move around.
Yes, actually, that's all there was room for. It had a double bed in it originally, and it had a small chair and like a reading lamp and a side table, and that was it. I found out much later, and in the book you can read at the end, mm-hmm. Exactly how many there were and how they were furnished. And after talking to some old folks, they confirmed that's all there was room for. It didn't have facilities. It didn't have a bathroom. And they were really common, and they were very modest, and they were all over the Midwest. You could find them all around Beardstown, the name of my hometown, like you said, mm-hmm. on the river. Mm-hmm. And that's not too far from Bloomington and Springfield and Jacksonville.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just a little roadside stop that tourists would go to on the way to other places.
I know that part of Illinois from old duck hunting trips out there. And
My gosh.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, very, very great duck hunting. I've got a brother-in-law who's a huge enthusiast. But, of course, it's not only in the Midwest you find these cottages. All over New England, much of the country in the 20s, when people were just starting to tour by car, these were, as soon as they gave up on tents, these were kind of the overnight accommodations that were so common, right?
It was. And what happened, and this is predates the Holiday Inns and the real yes. hotels and motels, people started driving. And as they were driving, they came up with a road system and the maps, which enabled people to take longer road trips. And they started out as tent cities, and people would stop and essentially camp out of their cars. And then it created a need for more housing. And so farmers and entrepreneurs started building these little cabin villages and renting them out, and sometimes they were themed. And you can still see them at different places across the states. Some are like teepee themes, and some look mm-hmm. like log cabins like ours did. Mm-hmm. It attracted more visitors when you had something that was more interesting than just like a shell of a building to sleep in.
White with hunter green trim, an absolutely kind of iconic picture of the little tourist cabin all over the country. We're going to hear the story of how yours ended up on the back of a big truck, ended up hauled all the way to Lakefront's little spot in Wisconsin, became your summer and maybe more than that idol. But Duo Dickinson, you've seen the pictures. You've looked into Teresa's project here.
I feel like I've looked into Teresa's soul. This book is this book is an amazing combination of sort of artfulness and memory and wonderful, the most generic and accessible type of construction you could possibly imagine.
Well, the wonderful thing I love about everybody loves a summer place. Yeah. In recent years, maybe the 90s and later, we've come to think of these huge sort of McMansion summer places. This reminds us it's not necessary to be big. The simpler, I mean, this is just a little box with a roof, and I mean little.
Well,
and yet the magic is
it's
there.
It's basically a room with a roof.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the word cottage is one of these loaded, oddball words, because it's really, you know, it's not a style, it's not a cape, it's not a ranch. It's sort of a mini-me of a cape in this case. It's also called and was called in the book a great deal a cabin, you know, and even in this particular
pretty
thing,
close.
The thing which I just love about it is and it was totally typical, is the fake log siding.
Right.
Where they rounded off these planks.
And, hemispheres of log.
Yeah, and it is probably, as I'm sure the author totally understands, the worst possible technological way you could ever side a house, because it just invites water to get behind them and everything begins to go to hell.
But it had resonance. I mean, because these were this was the cabin, there was the American frontier, all that stuff
is
somewhere in the background.
And it has these mitered corners where these faux perfect little loglets
right.
end up coming together.
Loglets.
And it is a very cute little thing.
Teresa, describe the location where your cottage, loglets and all, ends up. You know, you take a 250-mile truck ride with your cabin, your cottage, and plop it down where?
Sugar Creek, Wisconsin, which is right outside of Elkhorn, Wisconsin. It's about 90 miles from Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
So, and when you say a large truck, it's funny because it wasn't it was a pickup truck, really, and we slapped it in the back of a 40-foot trailer.
Trailer, yeah. That
it was a flatbed
right.
trailer, and we used a Bobcat to stick it on there, and mm-hmm. And it was a treacherous journey, but it made it 245 miles, driving quite slow because we weren't quite sure if the shingles were going to fly off.
People must have wondered. I see the picture on the interstate. They must I wonder why you were taking this anywhere. It was so dilapidated.
Oh, my. You know, and actually, I have to credit my husband and my little brother, Sam, for moving it. I was out of town on business, so I was calling him, yeah. driving him crazy every 20 minutes, saying, what's happened?
Are
the
you?
Logs flying onto windshields yeah. of other cars? Is it still there? And they made it. They made it. And we moved it to a little campground called Wandawega. And it used to be called Wandawega Lake Resort. And it was my husband's childhood summer camp, actually, that he'd always dreamed of buying. So we bought it about 6 years ago. And as soon as we got it, I immediately remembered the little cabin in my hometown, and I knew that it belonged there. It was my own modest cottage, as Thomas Jefferson talked about.
It's
and
a beautiful,
so we moved
it's
it
a beautiful
there.
Lake. I mean, I'm looking at the picture here and your property. So it's some very nice property, but just waiting as soon as you got your hands on it, I guess, for this icon of memory in your case.
Mm.
You know, that's exactly it. That's exactly it. And it's interesting because I don't think that we knew at the time when we decided to move it and once we planted it there what would happen and how obviously we would change the cabin and shape it and restore its youth. But in the end, it's really a bigger story about how it shaped us in that the process of fixing it up and restoring it gave us perspective about what's important and a sense of awareness.
You say, become, yeah.
You become very aware of all the conveniences that you take for granted when you don't have them.
Well, there's no kitchen in here. There's no bathroom in here. But yet, I mean, we'll look at what it took to restore this thing. You say you changed the shape, I guess, in a way, but it really is the essential, original, very much the original shape when you're finished. But I wonder, what do you think it was? What's the magic of this for you? I mean, you had, you know, you could have done a lot of things on that property. Duo here asks impishly, why didn't you just buy a cabin at Lowe's if you wanted a little shack, you know, or Home Depot? But what was it for you about this structure? What magic were you looking for there when you put it down by the lake and began to restore it?
Well, this particular structure, it carried a lot of sentimental value for me, and it was a piece of my hometown. I grew up in this town of 5,000 and 8 miles outside of town, so we were in the country. Mm-hmm. And then I moved away, like we all do sometimes, and we go to college, and then I've lived in Chicago for 14 years, and I missed it. And this felt like an opportunity for me to save a little piece of my hometown and bring it back and have it close to me. And I couldn't have ever fathomed buying one of those sheds at Home Depot. Nothing mm-hmm. against them. Mm-hmm. That could be someone's ideal cabin. But mm-hmm. for me, there was history in there and there was memories in there. I played in it and near it when I was a child, and my mother did. And so I felt like I wanted to save something. And it sounds odd, but I wanted to save a little lost soul in a mm-hmm. sense, because my whole life had been dreaming of taking the bus by it every day on the way to school. Mm. Every year I would see this thing fall apart. It was losing shingles, and then I'd lose windows, and then the door was falling off, and it just seemed wrong. So, and now that I'm an adult, it was actually feasible for the first time to do it. And of course, I have absolutely no experience in moving buildings. And I think all of those people out there that specialize in that would probably laugh when they look at some of the techniques that we used.
Oh yeah.
But we made it there, and it was such a joy to restore. And I think the way my book is written, because really I'm not even an author. I'm an art director. I'm a designer. I like to do interior decorating, but I do give some advice on how to build and how to restore, but it shouldn't be followed too closely because we just Googled a lot.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the endless appeal of the summer cottage, the summer shack. No matter how humble, no matter how small, Teresa Surratt joins us from Chicago. Her new book is A Very Modest College, the story of taking a 12x12, what had once been in the 1920s, a tourist cabin, and restoring it on a lakeside in Wisconsin. Duo Dickinson is with us as well. He's author of House on a Budget and many more, kind of a philosopher and architect of the smaller house. And we've got lots of callers already. Let's get some right in here. Harold in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Harold, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi. What's your story?
Well, I have a cabin in northern Idaho that's been in my family for over 100 years. Hmm. And I feel very fortunate to have this place.
Is it mega deluxe? Is it modest? What's it like?
It's a cabin. It's a cabin. Actually, it's two small cabins that have been. As I said, one has been in my family for over 100 years. The other one was acquired right next door about 40 years ago. And actually that one had been in my family as well, but sold in the 40s and then repurchased in the 70s.
And what do you feel when you're there, Harold? What's it do for you?
Well, it's a wonderful place. It's a beautiful place. The cabins are not insulated. They're old. They're, very kind of Spartan. But comfortable, and the place itself is, I think what's great about it is having had such a history there, it gives a sense of place to all the people who come to this place, and the people in this bay that we're in, people come from all parts of the country, and many families have been there for if not as long as we have, for many, many years.
Absolutely. In our kind of rolling stone culture where people and families separate and move all over the place to have a place to go back to, very powerful. 100 years in Idaho sounds pretty great. I want to get more stories. Nashville, Tennessee. Andrea, you're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi.
I was just calling to say my family has a cabin. It's in Canada, in Ontario, on the Georgian Bay.
Nice.
My dad actually bought an island when I was a child.
Lucky you.
It sounds very glamorous, and I always have to disclaim it and say, you know, it's really very rustic. It's about a two-acre island with and it's actually a big cabin, but it's very rustic. It's a big barn-shaped cabin. It was built in the 20s by the Indians, the Ojibwe Indians, with a huge granite stone fireplace, and there's no electricity, no running water. We have a composting toilet. When I was a kid, we had an outhouse.
And what's it do for you, for your family, when you're there, Andrea?
Well, it's been, you know, a place I grew up going to every summer since I was about 7 or 8.
Mm-hmm.
And as my husband's in academics, and we've moved around a lot, and my children, no matter where we lived, we've always gone up there in the summer, and it's sort of been the constant in our lives. And we go there, and we read books, and we play games, and we talk to each other, and we eat plain meals around the table together, and laugh a lot, and paddle our canoes and our kayaks, and it's just a lot different than everyday life back wherever we have lived around the country.
Life gets simple, and maybe we look at each other and talk to each other a little bit more. In Teresa Surratt's cabin, you'd hardly have a choice. At 12 by 12, you're facing each other all the time. Henry David Thoreau knew a little bit about living in a modest cabin. What his 10 by 15 shack at Walden, of course, he pulled up in, wrote in 1854 in the book about it. Here's a little sort of from book on tape, a passage from Thoreau describing his favorite type of architecture.
The most interesting dwellings in this country, as the painter knows, are the most unpretending, humble log huts and cottages of the poor commonly. It is the life of the inhabitants whose shells they are, and not any peculiarity in their surfaces merely, which makes them picturesque.
Narrator Alex Sand in Henry David Thoreau's voice there. Duo Dickinson, you're listening to our callers come in with their family stories already.
Well, I'm overwhelmed by the unending reality that homes are our largest set of clothing. And and what's very interesting is that, you know, Thoreau spent all of $28.12 to build his cottage, which is actually probably in today's money many, many times what Teresa spent to rebuild hers.
Still, nicely modest in its way.
And I just would like to interject one sort of highfalutin thought about what Teresa has and what all these other people have, which is one of the great tugs of war in American culture in terms of our buildings are... It really are between where homes really are for almost all of us, which living in our memory and living in our day-to-day family culture, and how they're viewed by architects, which is often as the building. Vitruvius called it the primitive hut. And they really become these rarefied distillations of aesthetics that can be quite off-putting. And to hear stories...
You mean our actual houses or cottages? Well,
think about this. The Glass House by Philip Johnson is his cottage. And that is a distilled, abstracted building in extremis.
I love it, though. Is there something wrong with it?
There's nothing wrong with it. It actually connects to the landscape in a way that a traditional cottage could never do.
It flows right in.
It flows right in. And so it's a very interesting thing that happens when human beings interact with the most essential. I mean, it's food, clothing, and shelter, the three essentials. Mm-hmm. And so when it becomes that essential and that personal in this little tiny place that you go to, usually a cottage means that you don't earn your living there. It's mm-hmm. a place where you go to get away from where you earn your living.
Mm-hmm.
And it becomes this mirror of who you are. And you could think about cottages as being the most clearest reflective mirror of the personalities of their owners versus, you know, architects tend to think about buildings as being things they control or control their owners.
Teresa, did you set out to do that, to show yourself in this restored little cabin, or to show your grandmother, to show the 1920s? What were you aiming for?
I think in my case, it was more about restoring it accurately, as closely as I could, to what it would have looked like back in the 1920s when it sat on the outskirts of my hometown
mm-hmm.
with its brothers and sisters. I really wanted people to walk in past that threshold and feel like they stepped back in time. I wanted everything that goes into it, whether it was the bark cloth curtains or it was the antique writing table or the potbelly stove to have a story behind it. So each piece had to be antique and period as well, so that people could really feel like they're going to a different place. You had mentioned earlier being taken to another world. Mm-hmm. And that's what I wanted our guests to feel. I wanted them to feel the history in it and the memories, the residual karma of all the visitors that had come before us that had used this little cottage. In the book, I talk about all the different lives the cottage had led before mm-hmm. we got it. And it's pretty remarkable for a room that small. It had been moved 4 times prior. Mm. So I think for me, it was just about reflecting its history.
Now, interestingly, though, that in its own way may be reflecting you. I mean, I know you're a great flea market collector and I think an antiquer. I mean, talk about memories and residual karma. That's what you have aimed for in much of your life. And so here it is in your cottage, too.
Yeah. I think that's true. I think, and going all the way back to when I was a child, even like I was probably 4, I remember playing in it. My father had built us a little cottage. We had 15 acres in the country outside mm-hmm. Beardstown. And he built this little cottage, smaller than the one we have now, out of the boards and timbers from other houses that had fallen. And they were other abandoned houses. And so we had this teeny little house. And it didn't last that long, and I always missed it. So I wonder if that was part of the attraction for me to save the other small cottage as well. And you're right. I think that's a reoccurring theme in everything that I do. And even where we put the cottage in the rest of the camp, I want to preserve history. I want to preserve the stories that these antiques carry with them.
Bring it back. Maybe even bring back the hand of your father in a way. Mike in Boston. You're on the air, Mike.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm headed up to my little cabin, my chalet, the Shaggy Chalet, I call it.
Shaggy Chalet, I love it.
Yeah, it's shag carpeting. It is my little getaway. It's just a small little A-frame. I've got 10 acres of land. So one of the best things is there's no cell phone service in the town. I don't have a TV up there. I don't have a phone. It's just a place to get away and relax and decompress and recharge myself.
Where is it, Mike? Are you going up to Maine, down Maine, New Hampshire?
I'm going to Warren, New Hampshire.
All right.
It's a small town. If you've ever driven through a small town that has a redstone missile in the center of the town, that's it.
And when you're there in your shaggy chalet, where's your mind go?
It goes back to when I was a kid. My family had a house in the same small little town. Memories of back to a kid. I have my own children now. It's trying to recreate some of those memories. It's taking them and showing them a different way of life, you know, that they don't need a TV to have fun. We have the board game shelf that we never seem to have time to play with during our normal busy lives.
So you keep a past alive, but it's also a kind of mindset or a way of interacting with the world. And I'm also hearing here a theme of maybe that mental freedom of childhood that comes with a lot of these places. Mike, drive safely and enjoy the shaggy chalet there. Let's get a call from New Hampshire, Hanover, New Hampshire. Ellen, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Yes, you mentioned Thomas Jefferson at the beginning.
Yes, very, very much. He's inspired the title here with his very modest cottage quote. Yes.
Yes, but he did have a summer place about 60 miles southwest of Charlottesville, mm-hmm. Monticello, mm-hmm. in other words.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I'm not sure how well it's known. It's called Poplar Forest.
I didn't know of it. That was his summer shack?
I guess. I always heard as a child that this was his summer place. And I remember going to a birthday party there. And it seemed to me as a child just slightly decrepit. I don't think anyone lived there. I think it passed through several hands. And since then, it's been beautifully restored. And it is a bit like Monticello. I can't tell you how much because I haven't been there.
Wow. Well, Ellen, thanks for reminding that. Let me just read the full quote again that Teresa Surratt has right in the front of her, A Very Modest Cottage. This is Thomas Jefferson, 3rd President of the United States. I would rather be shut up in a very modest cottage with my books, my family, and a few old friends, dining on simple bacon and letting the world roll on as it liked, than to occupy the most splendid post which any human power can give. And that's wonderful and a very comely photo of you, Teresa, next to it here. But I must say, I thought it was rich. Thomas Jefferson talking about a simple cottage. Didn't he bankrupt himself building Monticello, sort of spend the national debt practically
on
that?
He actually never stopped building Monticello.
Right. It's wonderful. I love it.
He was an obsessive compulsive of the first order.
But Teresa, Monticello is sort of the opposite. It is the grand and inventive home with every architectural, development of the day in it. Hardly your 12 by 12-er.
I know, but I fell in love with that quote, as I think we all do. Yeah. I found it in a magazine almost 6-7 years ago, and I tore it out. It just resonated with me. With it, there was a lovely little photo of a old screen door, the kind that you would bang in the summer cottages. And it was very simple and very elegant. And I posted it up on my wall. And I had it for years. And then I thought, when I saw the cabin in my hometown a couple of years later, again, I'm like, that's my modest cottage. I put it together. And then I just really wanted to sort of figure out a way to move it then. And then when it came time much later to write the book, when someone asked me to write the full story, it never crossed my mind to consider a title anything other than A Very Modest Cottage, because I think that he articulated that so well. It was just perfect. And it just sums everything up. About how we feel about when we go visit our cottages or our summer homes, or in some cases it's, again, campgrounds, our favorite camping spot. It could be a summer camp you go to as a child. We just all share these beautiful memories of growing up and going to places like this.
I used to go to a little, actually one of these tourist cabin, places that existed way past its time out in the Berkshire.
Well, one thing
12 bucks a night, I recall, right on the lake, teeny tiny. There was nothing but the bed, basically, inside. And then, but who cared? You could sleep, be in the lake, be in the sun, woo!
It's perfect. It's perfect, right?
What is really interesting in hearing all of this is the speaking of the word memory, and I think it's, to me, it's quite different. It's actually suspension of time, not hearkening back, because you're living.
Timelessness.
It's timelessness because you're actually living in real time in a suspension of the things that make us crazy. The idea that there isn't cell phone, the fact that you can play board games that could have been played 5,000 years ago and will be played 5,000 years from now, that makes this into this kind of prototype place, this decompression chamber. Remember back in the 70s, they had sensory deprivation chambers?
Right.
Well, I think that basically you can make a case that any really wonderful house, but especially one that is this distilled, can form that level of allowing who you are beneath all of the day-to-day to come out in that warm and embracing environment.
Of course, once you have timelessness, then the past is also there with you.
Bingo.
You pull the book out and it's got that little smell of time. Lance in Jamestown, Rhode Island. Lance, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. What's your story, Lance?
A one-room schoolhouse that's in upstate New York on the side of a mountain. It's still the way it was when it was a schoolhouse. It has the schoolhouse lights. It has a wood-burning stove. It has a door for girls and a door for boys.
Wow.
It's surrounded by fields, and an organic farmer who's actually, his name is Bill Eklund, and he was written up in the New York Times 2 or 3 weeks ago because he now has an organic traveling slaughterhouse.
Wonderful. And do you get up there most summers, Lance?
We get up there in the summer. We actually go up in the winter. It's not centrally heated. It's not insulated. But we bring a lot of wood and crank up the heat. And we've been up there in February when it's really, really bad and it's very, very dramatic. The snow comes up, above the windows.
Do you find a different self there, Lance? Do you find a better self? Your true self there?
It's absolutely wonderful. It just, you wake up in the morning and you look out the window and there are cows right next to the house grazing. It's sometimes the cows break out and we'll help the farmer put them back in the field. The people up there are very different than they are here in, so to speak, civilized society. They're mountain people and they're very interesting. They have a different way of life. And when we go up there, we try to take on that way of life when we're up there.
Lance, you're terrific to share the story with us. We're right up there on the mountainside with your one-room schoolhouse. Teresa Surratt in Chicago, please stand by, author of A Very Modest Cottage, and Duo Dickinson, architect with me in the studio today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the endless appeal of the summer cottage, the summer shack, no matter how humble, no matter how small. We heard a little bit from Walden earlier. Here's more of narrator Alex Sand reading from Henry David Thoreau's classic about his 10 by 15 foot cabin he built on Walden Pond.
So I went on for some days, cutting and hewing timber, and also studs and rafters, all with my narrow axe, not having many communicable or scholar-like thoughts. I hewed the main timbers 6 inches square, most of the studs on two sides only, and the rafters and floor timbers on one side, leaving the rest of the bark on, so that they were just as straight and much stronger than sawed ones.
Henry David Thoreau on Walden Pond in 1854. Teresa Surratt has taken a cottage from her grandma's backyard, a 1920s tourist cottage, and plopped it down on a lovely little lake site in Wisconsin. She's written about it in A Very Modest Cottage, kind of a meticulous telling of how she and her husband and her brother restored this cottage and their sort of a soul trip along the way, I guess. Duo Dickinson is with us as well, great architect out of Connecticut, sort of a philosopher of architecture. He'd written House on a Budget, Small Houses for a New Century,
yeah,
and a whole lot more. Just terrific. We've got so much online here. Here's a comment on Facebook from Kelly. Our first family cabin was built in 1922 from a Sears catalog and burned down in a wood stove fire in 1932. The family rebuilt in 1935, and that is the cabin we still summer in today. And another from Maggie in Maine. It's called Camp. Ours has been in the family since my grandfather built it in the 60s. No insulation, board and batten siding. The best is the framed photographs and log books from when my grandparents stayed there every summer. Let's go to Peter in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. Peter, you're on the air.
Hello, how are you doing, Tom?
Pretty well. What's your story?
Well, I'm calling from St. Jay, and I was just at our camp. It's at Joe's Pond, Vermont, in West Danville, Vermont.
Great.
It's a pretty small place. It's been there for a while. And I think it's not only about the house that's there or our cottage there, it's the camp, as we call it, but it's where it is. You know, it's amazing. At night, I was out 2 evenings ago. It was completely clear. I took out our 10-inch telescope, and I was pointing it out into space. And you get those moments where it's quiet, it's dark, and you're peering into the, you know, it far away. And then, you know, you hear the loons crying out, you know, across the lake. And it's that serenity, that peace. And then you got the fire going. It's amazing. It clears my mind to do a lot of work in cities. So when I get out there, you know, during the summer, my family's camp, it just clears your mind. It really changes the way you think.
Peter, that's a great report from St. Jay. You've put us right there, and I appreciate it so much. Thank you for that call. Here's Kristen writing in and saying, one can't talk about summer places without touching on E.B. White's wonderful essay titled Once More to the Lake. It's about going back to the camp on Belgrade Lake in Maine where White went as a young boy, about his return as an adult with his son in tow. And there's that timelessness, that past and present all together. Duo, you've been thinking through Teresa's story about Teresa and her father and the kind of cultures that patchwork this country.
Teresa, I've never met you, but I will shock all of the people in the Midwest by saying that you, and especially I think your dad, who is very touchingly remembered in your book, really are swamp Yankees. Swamp Yankees, what nobody quite gets, and what I love about what you did is that, you know, buildings used to be things that you saved and did not tear down. You know, the greenest building in the world is the one you don't demolish. And so houses would be moved all over the place, but typically houses were moved away from the shore because people that lived by the water in, you know, the 17th, 18th, 19th century, those were the poor people. Those are the people that couldn't afford to live inland, because and they were devastated with every hurricane and flood and every, they were called the Swamp Yankees. And a Swamp Yankee never, ever throws anything out that can be recycled. A Swamp Yankee thinks about things for months and years, and then in excruciating detail saves 5 cents by spending 500 hours to make something exactly right. And it just harkened back to a phrase that an ad man told me one time that I'd love to the listeners to think about for a second. You could base any endeavor, any built endeavor that you have comes down to only three factors, or only three criteria. There's good, there's fast, and there's cheap. But you can only get two of them, because if it's good and fast, it won't be cheap. If it's cheap and fast, it won't be good. But the truth is, what you got was good and cheap, so it wasn't fast. And that is the Swamp Yankee credo. I don't have a lot of money. I want it to be good, so it's going to take a long time.
And some elbow grease. I think you're onto something. I mean, Beardstown, that's kind of the Swamp Yankee part of Illinois, yeah, I'd say.
It is. They called us River Rats. I have River to Rats. Say, Duo, I've never been more proud to be called a Swamp Yankee.
Maybe never been called one at all.
No, my father, I know he's laughing right now because he would agree with you completely. And I have to say on that, we had horses growing up as well, and we had a huge barn. And my father built that from salvaged lumber from other fallen
yes.
barns around us.
Yes.
And then when I was in college to Wyoming to work on a ranch, he took an abandoned cabin. It was another stable of sorts, and he converted it to his house. And that was probably, 20 by 30, so it was large, comparatively speaking, to what we've just done. But you're exactly right, and that's so insightful, and I'm glad that you could get that from the book, because I think that I didn't know it at the time, but I've been learning from my father all of those years how to salvage and how to glean and how to see the value in historical things. Even when we had the horses, I remember we would go gleaning. I don't know if you know what that means, but we would go to the neighbor's crops. Of course, we, grew up in the country surrounded by cornfields. So we would go out and pick up.
Pick or miss.
You get all those leftovers, right?
Yep.
Exactly.
We sure did. And of course, we had five horses to feed. There were five kids. And so it was a lot of fun. We jumped in the back of the pickup and we would just fill it with corn and sit on the top and head home.
Think about it, there's so much confusion in our culture today about energy efficiency, sustainability, green architecture. So much of what you and your father who your father was, is going back to the real green roots of our culture. And I think it's wonderful.
Yes, yes.
Let's get a call from Salt Lake City, Utah. Mark, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I don't want to rain on your upper middle class idyll, but I submit to you.
Are you calling our Swamp Yankees upper middle class idyllists?
Idyllators.
Idyllators? What do you see, Mark?
I submit to you and your guests that most people go to cottages to experience nature. Mm-hmm. And if, in fact, we were to apply the Kantian imperative that we have to consider the nature of our actions in light of what would happen if everyone else did the same thing, 350 million Americans accommodated in town and 350 million Americans accommodated in the country very quickly leaves very little room for nature.
You know, I hear that resonating out of the West in particular. You're in Utah, where we all know about all these communities that have grown up on the edges of or in the middle of great wild scenes, maybe for better, maybe for worse. But I do take issue with the upper middle class piece. I've known a lot of fishing camps that had nothing fancy about them. But, Mark, there's a sort of what do you do here with your Kantian imperative up against your Thoreauvian imperative that if we don't get out there, we sort of forget what life's all about?
Well, remember that I think Thoreau was actually talking about his primary residence. He wasn't talking about his cozy little place in the country where he could go, like Marie Antoinette, at her amour and play at being a shepherd.
Well, that's true for the time he spent there, but then most of his life wasn't on Walden Pond. What's your suggestion then, Mark? What about those huddled masses in the cities yearning to breathe some sweet green air? What should they do?
Well, you don't actually have to possess, you don't have to own the cottage in the country. And the
Quite
other
true.
Alternative, of course, is to camp, but some of our great campgrounds in the national forests.
Yep. A great suggestion, and we've tried to say from the very top, you don't have to own it. You may rent it, borrow it, or just take your tent. But, Mark, we appreciate that wonderful Utah perspective. Let me get one more, if I may, from Newton, Massachusetts. Jay, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What do you know?
I just thought I'd tell you about my place in Grand Lake Stream, Maine. It's been in our family since 1872, and we've had a diary every day of the year since 1872 to today.
Wow.
That's so cool.
So the family can go and read about five generations ago and horses falling through the ice in February, or, you know, babies being born on the kitchen table. And it's right now, it's just a summer place. And about the paper companies used to own, Georgia Pacific was the last paper company to own the land around us. And they sold it to a third party. And the first thing that happened was they decided there were lots of lakes, and they'd put a road in. And the little village, Grand Lake Stream, which has 125 year-round residents, started a grassroots effort to preserve the land. And we have, they've asked people from outside the community, I was one, to be on a board. And we started the Grand, the Down East Lakes Land Trust. And we've preserved 33,000 acres around Grand Lake Stream. And we're in the middle of doing another 22,000 acres right now. And that's sort of the hole in the donut. Outside of that, we bought the development rights to 300 and plus or minus 20,000 acres. And then with what we abut in Canada, the Crown there put another 400,000 acres in conservation. And with what the Native Americans own and some of the federal lands, we have about 1.3 million in conservation. They're one contiguous block of land.
So, Jay, you're really speaking to our caller Mike in Utah with that effort. I mean, it's terrific. But when you're all done with that, where can I put my little cottage?
Unfortunately, we would invite you to stay at one of the lodges in Grand Lake Stream.
Right.
And,
there you go.
Quite a few. And their guides and their canoes and all the recreation everybody else has talked about. And
it's a great story, Jay. I appreciate your sharing it with us. Teresa Surratt, what did the habitués of Wandawega Lake area around Elkhorn, Wisconsin, make of your little cabin when they drive by? Did they think you were ridiculous bringing in this little pipsqueak, you know, summer place or more?
That's what I love about Lake Wandawega. It was developed in the early 20s, and all of the cabins around there are quite modest. They're typical Wisconsin cabins with they're made from the land, and that they have stone foundations and lots of cedar and little stone chimneys, and it fit right in. And they saw it going down the road, of course, in the back of the truck. but now that it's tucked away, you can't really see it unless you go to find it. And I think that everyone's really embraced it. The remarkable thing is once my brother had said it with my husband, it looked like it had always been there. And that was my dream. That's what I wanted. I wanted to nestle it within the trees to make it feel like it had been there since the 1920s. And that was part of the restoration process as well, and the color scheme, et cetera. So they embraced it. And it's everyone's favorite place to go, kids and adults alike. When they do come over to visit, everyone runs to the cabin because it's still a playhouse, but a playhouse for adults now as well.
Let me get one more call from Schroon Lake, New York. That sounds like good cabin country. Jackie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, I'm actually calling from Schroon Lake, New York, but our cottage is in Paradox Lake, which is up the road.
Wonderful.
We come to Schroon Lake to get our cell service. If you want to go to a coffee cafe, you can get some internet to check emails if you have to.
Yeah.
Although I try not to, and I'm here for library books. My daughter is a chicken pox. So
it's summertime. Okay, I got it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's an amazing place, and we've been very lucky, and I married into this great gem of a place in Paradox Lake, and the cottage we stay in is really stopped in time, and there's no greater feeling than taking your wristwatch off and putting schedules aside and, you know, rising with the sun and going to sleep with the moon. I think that's the greatest gift that the country air brings. And I think the one quandary that I bring to this that I haven't heard from others is that you know, I very tenderly say this without passing judgment, is that we're nestled in a place with a couple of cottages, with family and other cottages. And while my husband and I are really into preserving what's there and maintaining what is stopped in time, I see sort of a modernization being peeled away. And, I mean, the original aspects of the cottage being peeled away and other cottages that are close to us and modernization pouring in. And it's really hard for me. It's hard for both of us to see this happening, you know, the ritual of going to town to do laundry and talking to locals and hearing local news. Suddenly the next cottage over has a washing machine and dryer or a microwave and a new kitchen. And, you know, it's again, not trying to pass judgment, but it's so painful. It's almost like, you know, you can't get it back. You take away the history and you take away the old stuff and it's gone forever. And it's really bruising. It's hard to deal with.
Jackie, you paint that picture wonderfully. Our time is short, but it's interesting. Teresa, as you listen in Chicago, I mean, here you were doing just the opposite. You were turning back the hands of time. Jackie's in her idol, as Mike has it, and, you know, the hands of time are turning forward toward washing machines and maybe even televisions blaring out the window next door. Oh, boy. How do you, I don't know which way you go in time with your cottage. I guess not that way in your case.
Jackie, I'm totally with you. I can feel exactly what you're saying. I can see that happening in a few places around us, and it is heartbreaking. Some would argue that you shouldn't be so emotionally attached to objects, but we are. We are, and I think that it's okay, and it's important to embrace it. And my husband sits on the board of directors for the Landmarks, and so we're all about preserving architecture and preserving buildings and finding the value in the simplicity that not having new technology offers you. So we subscribe. We're right there with you, and I hope the listeners out there can go home, and if they have a cottage, not consider getting a washer and dryer because it's just more fun to use the clothesline.
Do Dickinson. We just got half a minute. A final thought for the cottage season?
Well, just think about this. In the last 30 years, building sites in America have gotten 30% smaller. Families have lost a person on average. But our houses have doubled in size. What we can really learn from a book like this and just from small houses in general is that you don't need a giant house to have a full heart.
Amen to that. And beautifully manifested in Teresa's Little Cabin on the Lake. Teresa Surratt's book is A Very Modest Cottage. She joined us today from Chicago. Teresa, we'll think of you up there on your Wisconsin lake. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
And Duo Dickinson, it is awesome to see you again. Listeners, you can see photographs of houses Duo's designed at our website, onpointradio.org. Duo, thank you so much for coming in.
Pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thanks for joining us.